And it is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper with you. 7 minutes past 1 o'clock, along with Bonnie Berman. Have you been busy today, Bonnie? We haven't heard you very much.
Yes, we've been busy. It's our fall fund drive, and it's been a busy few days.
And we'll be looking for some support. But first, we welcome Princeton University Professor of Psychology and Public Affairs. He's Eldar Shafir. He's the co-author of Scarcity, Why Having Too Little Means So Much. And he joins us from the Broadcast Center at Princeton, New Jersey. Welcome to you. Is it Dr. Eldar Shafir or just professor?
Just professor is fine. A pleasure to be with you.
Okay,
well, thanks so much for joining us. There are so many implications of your research and your findings. I'd like to begin, though, with the interesting story how you and your co-author, Senthil Melanathan, developed your interest in studying the psychology of scarcity. If you would tell us that story.
Well, we started by trying to understand better the decision-making that occurs in contexts of poverty, of monetary poverty. We were studying the poor both in the U.S. and abroad, in India and other places. And, you know, the elephant in the room in many discussions is the fact that the poor often seem to be doing poorly in the decisions they make. They adhere to their medications less well than the rich. They seem to be less patient and attentive to their children than those who are well off. They make a lot of financial errors. So we try to understand better what's happening there and ended up with a much larger theory about what happens when we simply don't have enough, financially or otherwise.
A reviewer described your book as a combination of heart and head. Would you agree with that?
That's a lovely compliment. We hope so. It's, you know, we care about this very much and seem to have made some scientific discoveries that seem to matter.
You say that although physical scarcity is everywhere, the psychological experience of scarcity is not. Would you explain that?
Yeah, you know, the science of economics, the discipline of economics is focused on the fact that there is, you know, everything is finite. So when you go to buy a sandwich or buy a CD or a book, those are $5 or $10 you'll never see again. And so from an economics perspective, that's important. Even if you have a lot, you know, every $5 you spend is $5 less to have to, you know, bequeath your children or give to charity or anything else. We, through our studies, seem to find that psychologically, at least when we make those small purchases, we don't think about what we might not be able to buy instead. It's as if we reach into an infinite bucket of small sums of money and we act like it's of no consequence and will have no impact on anything else we do. All that changes when we don't have enough.
You say that busy people fail to manage their time for the same reason the poor fail to manage their money. Could you explain that?
Well, the story the discovery we made essentially is if you look at how people attend to what they need to do. You know, we have a finite space behind the eyes and between the ears. Our brains are limited. We only have so much cognitive space, so much attention we can devote to things. And what we find is that when you don't have enough of something, it could be not enough friends if you feel lonely. It could be, you know, being busy counting calories if you're dieting. And certainly if you don't have enough time or enough money, you devote a lot of mental space, a lot of energy, a lot of focus. You tunnel on those issues, managing your money, managing your time when you feel you don't have enough of it. And when you do that, when you devote so much bandwidth, so much mental effort to that topic, there is just less mind left for other things.
Give us an idea of you personally where scarcity has affected your life, an example.
Well, I'm lucky enough to experience mostly scarcity in time as opposed to money. And I say that because, you know, to some extent, all of us who are very busy, you know, don't tell anybody, but we do this because we choose to. If we decided to be less busy, in most cases, that would be doable. It's a discretionary choice we make to try to do a lot with our lives. When you don't have enough money, of course, all that's very different. You can't really choose to not be poor for a week and then, you know, go back to it if you feel like it. And so in that sense, it's a very different sort of scarcity. In my life, time scarcity is a main thing. And what that means is that when I'm running around trying to manage my excessive commitments, I make mistakes. I forget to pick up my kids on time. I forget that I left my car at a parking meter intending fully to be back in time so as to avoid the ticket. I just make errors of that sort. And of course, you know, I may not have written my will yet, although I should have done this years ago. I have not checked whether my savings for retirement account is the best I could arrange for it to be, because I'm running, micromanaging, focusing on my day-to-day temporal obligations and neglecting other things that might actually be more important, but that are relegated to the periphery while I'm focusing on managing my scarcity right now.
So these studies are applicable to those who experience scarcity, enduring scarcity, and scarcity on an ongoing basis, as well as those who experience it intermittently?
Indeed. You know, in some cases, in some of these experiments, we, as it were, induce scarcity at the moment. We put you in a context. We put Princeton students, for example, in a lab in a context where now they have a hard time managing their time as they're trying to collect points and make money in an experiment. And the minute we put them in a situation where they don't have enough time, compared to a different condition where they had the same game with enough time at their hands, they start showing the classic errors and mistakes that, you know, the poor would make with money.
I suppose most people would say that a scarcity of time is more palatable than a scarcity of money.
Right. So as I was saying, time is something that in most cases, at least, you know, you could be poor in experiencing time scarcity in terms of managing to go from job one to job two just to able to survive. So there are, you know, special cases that's not quite the case. But many of the listeners, many of us who experience great time scarcity, somewhere in the back of our minds, we know that if we fail to abide by the deadline, if we miss some meeting at the end of the day, not much happens. Whereas if you don't have enough money, that's a very different story. If you can't put food on the table or you can't pay rent and get evicted, that's a whole different level of mental weight as you go from day to day.
Would you go back to the mental bandwidth? Because I found that pretty interesting, and the cognitive control, the limitations thereof, and how it affects our ability to deal with scarcity. Would you just explain more?
Yes, let me tell you a study we did.
Okay.
Let me give you a study, give you a sense of it. So we go to a mall in New Jersey and ask shoppers to participate, to volunteer to participate in a study. And we place them in front of a computer screen where we give them a couple of cognitive tests. These are classic tests that have been used for 30 or 40 years that either test your cognitive control, your divided attention, your ability to manipulate tasks mentally, you know, kind of respond quickly and things like that. Or we give them a fluid intelligence. Basically, it's a component of IQ test. And when we give them these tests, in the background, we present them with financial scenarios that they should that they need to contemplate. Let's assume a car breaks down and you need to fix it. And those come in two varieties. In some cases, the car is easy to fix. It's going to cost you $150, which we know most people in the mall can afford. In other cases, the car is going to be a real challenge. It's going to cost you $1,500, which is not simple for many people in the mall. So you consider how to take care of this scenario, this car, and you respond to these cognitive tests. We divide people by household income, you know, simply by splitting them halfway in the middle between rich and poor. And let's look at what happens. If you look at the poor and the rich in the mall, those who are on the upper half of income, whether they contemplate the cheaper or the more expensive car, they do equally well on the cognitive tests. They do equally well on the IQ tests and on the cognitive control, the divided attention tests. The poor in the mall, when they contemplate the cheaper car, the easier car to fix, look just like the rich. Their cognitive performance on the divided attention, you know, it's like a driving test, and on IQ is just like the rich. But when the poor people in the mall are contemplating the expensive car they need to fix, a challenge which is not easy to resolve, they now do significantly less well in cognitive control and do substantially less well in fluid intelligence. They score roughly 13 IQ points lower.
13?
When they're 13 IQ points lower when they're worried about a car that's hard to fix as compared to when they were worried minutes ago about a car that was easier to fix. And 13 IQ points is, you know, on a qualitative scale, that's enough to take you from average to borderline deficient or to borderline gifted, depending if you go up and down. So it's a substantial effect. It compares roughly to a night of no sleeping on your cognitive abilities.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah. You conducted studies as well with the sugarcane farmers in India, and you measured their mental function as well. Would you tell us about that study?
Yes, so the mall study, we know we controlled for everything we could, but of course at the end of the day, we're comparing richer and poorer Americans, and although we've done all the controls, you know, these are different populations. They often have different health, different education. So the dream was, can we do this within subject? Can we have the same person perform when they're rich and when they're poor? Of course, that's not easy to do, to find somebody who's both rich and poor. Mm-hmm. But the third world gives you some cases where that's pretty manageable, and particularly in farming. So sugarcane farming is a good example because the harvest in sugarcane occurs exactly once a year. So the bulk of your income occurs in one shot, in one time. And so these are people who basically get all their income in one time and have to basically smooth their spending throughout the year until the next harvest. And because they're living with not quite enough and fail to smooth, These are farmers who typically find themselves rich after the harvest and poor just before the harvest. So now we go to these guys. These are the same people now who we give these tests to 4 months apart, 2 months before harvest when you're poor and 2 months after the harvest when you're rich. Notice now the education, the health, everything is identical. And what we find is that these farmers, when they're poor before the harvest, score about 10 IQ points lower than after harvest. And they do equally badly in the cognitive control tests that we found in New Jersey.
You talk about time management, Professor. I always find that it's easy to commit to a project if someone asked you, say, a month ahead of time, could you dog sit for me next month when we're on vacation? And next month comes and the reality sets in and you realize, why did I commit my time to that? I really shouldn't be doing that. Any comment?
Indeed. Yeah, there's a lot of work on, you know, what economists would call temporal discounting, how much weight the time has on you now as opposed to a month from now. And, you know, I've always been amused by this. You know, when somebody calls and asks you, can you come visit in a year, I find myself opening the calendar, and guess what? A year from now, it's wide open. And that was amusing me because, of course, the point is that what I'm doing now is committing to something where it's going to become harder and harder to pack in as the time approaches and other obligations emerge. And so there's both kind of a planning fallacy and a psychology to it. Basically, you fail to remember that as time approaches, there will be other things that come up that right now don't show their ugly face. And you fail to account for what it will take to do once you get there. Traveling a year from now is easy. Traveling tomorrow all of a sudden requires, you know, tickets and reservations and driving and security and all this stuff that a year from now looks very distant. And part of what we talk about managing scarcity is, you know, we use the metaphor of a suitcase that you pack tightly. And when you commit to something a year from now, you've just put an item into that suitcase, which will become tighter and tighter to pack as you get closer.
I want to go back to that suitcase because I really loved that metaphor. Okay. We're speaking with Professor of Psychology and Public Affairs at Princeton University, Eldar Shafir. He conducts research in cognitive science, judgment and decision making, and behavioral economics. And he co-authored the book Scarcity, Why Having Too Little Means So Much, on today's Topical Currents. I just want to remind you, we're not fundraising during Topical Currents, but it is our fall fund drive. And so if you'll kindly go to the phone and make your contribution, we'd really appreciate it. It's 866-247-9576 to contribute, or you can do so online. 2 minutes either way, WLRNradio.org. Stay with us, Professor Shafir. We need to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
And it is today's Topical Currents, 21 minutes past 1 o'clock. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation with Princeton University Professor of Psychology and Public Affairs. He's Eldar Shafir, and he's the co-author of Scarcity, Why Having Too Little Means So Much. Professor, how did you and Sendhil
Melanathan
get together to create this book?
We've been working together for several years.
And he's at Harvard.
He's at Harvard Economics, yes. We met at a Russell Sage Foundation Behavioral Economics Roundtable. It's a group that gets together to do research and conduct and discuss behavioral economics topics. And Sendhil was mostly doing work on developmental economics in the third world and other places. I was doing work in decision making, and we kind of got together and decided that the decision making in context of poverty was a topic that was worth some attention.
What kind of economics were you talking about?
He was doing development economics originally.
But not voodoo economics.
No, developmental. So this is an interest in, you know, the economics mostly of, you know, third world nations, right, and developing countries.
Professor, I'm interested to know if this scarcity, it seems like it's an instinct, if it has evolutionary roots.
Well, you know, sure. I mean, we evolved in contexts that presented scarcity. And we talk about in the book about, you know, sort of animal models. You know, in the animal world, it's interesting. When you're a zebra being chased by a lion, the only thing you do is devote all you have to escaping. You stop everything else. You stop, you know, your reproductive issues, your digestive metabolism. Everything stops just in the attempt to make it and get away. And so in some sense, you focus all you've got on this escape. You know, this is a far-fetched jump. I'm not sure to what extent evolution produced what we find in the lab and in our studies. But there is something psychological that's similar to it. When you don't have enough, when you're focused on not having enough food, enough time, enough money, you focus on it enormously, put an enormous part of your mind on dealing with those issues. And what's interesting is, you know, when we look at the decision-making made by the poor, they do exceedingly well on the problems they're trying to solve. They're very effective trying to put down the fires that are occurring right now in their daily lives. It's just that when you focus so much on what you're doing right now, you neglect everything else, a little bit like the zebra. And when you neglect everything else, some of those things come back to haunt you. They cost a lot. When you take a payday loan to solve something right now, it's very effective at solving your problem, but it leaves you with a greater debt 2 weeks from now, and things derail.
And what other kind of examples can you give of things that we neglect because we're so focused?
Well, again, it could be anything from money to time. So as I mentioned, one of the painful things, if you look at sort of the research on the behavior of the poor, is that as they're managing their finances from day to day and doing that rather well, there's a lot they neglect. They have less patience and less energy left for their children at the end of the day. They attend to their kids less. They read with them less. They forget to take their medications on time. Mm. If you're a poor farmer in India, you weed your fields less well and less consistently than the richer farmers. And so in some sense, all throughout your life, many aspects of your life suffer from the enormous amount of bandwidth you're dedicating to solving your everyday financial scarcity.
For those who have
Think about an air traffic controller. It's a good example. Think of an air traffic controller who's managing many planes in the air, and all of a sudden you have one plane with, you know, serious trouble, you know, a fire in the engine. All your attention goes to this one plane, which makes a lot of sense. At the same time, a lot of other planes in the air get neglected, and some of that could have very bad consequences.
Mm-hmm. What about if you're working on some important things, either for work or for school, and yet you're still, for some reason, preoccupied with little things that really don't count?
What's the behavior of that? It's an important multitasking challenge. So many of us, this goes back to, let's call it the luxury of having your scarcity in time rather than money. Many of us who have a lot on our minds are able to some extent to put things aside when we need to. So right now when we're having this wonderful conversation, all of us have other concerns, but we're able to some extent at least to put them aside until 2 o'clock when we can resume taking care of those things. The problem occurs in moments when the things that bother you are strong enough, stressing, pressing enough on your mind that they're hard to put out of the way. In the studies we did in New Jersey Mall and with the farmers in India, what seems to be the case is when you're managing very stressful financial scarcity, it's hard to put it out of the way during the time you're doing the tests that we give you. And right now, if we have serious enough issues, maybe if you have a child who is sick at home, or even if you just had a very bad fight with your spouse this morning, you might be doing this interview less well. And when something is chronic, when you're managing scarcity of money, it's not something that comes occasionally and goes. It's there every day, and it affects your performance.
You mentioned children. I'd like you to tell us about your study about childhood poverty. It was very dismal, your findings about their brain development and their cognitive function.
Well, I should say this is not our study. This is literature that we review of
pharmaceutical
and other biological studies. That's fine. These are extremely important work that finds, you know, from very early on in childhood, sometimes even prenatal, in utero, things start happening, everything from exposure to language to nutrition to stress that have a long-term impact. In a sense, we're complementing that because what we're looking at is things, you know, if you think about the studies we talked about, these are not from birth, in the sense that we find them coming and going in real time as cognitive problems emerge and subside. So when I give you a more complicated problem to deal with, all of a sudden your performance diminishes, your IQ goes down, and when the problems are more manageable, it goes up. So independent of any other biological long-lasting issues, what we find here is very short-term cognitive effects that impinge on the rest of your life.
What about cultural differences, say Asian versus Western or African cultures? And I suppose the Zen Buddhist doesn't have too much time to deal with scarcity then.
There are cultural differences. You know, if you study the brain, if you come from the discipline that I come from, having to do with cognitive science and our mental capacities, to a very large extent, at least I come from a school that believes we all carry the same machinery behind the eyes and between the ears. So, you know, there could be some cultural differences, but for all we know, anybody, if you have them rehearse too much in their cognitive working memory, in their cognitive space, there's going to be less space left for other things. So, you know, there's old studies, many studies have been done in the last 3 decades, where I simply give you a seven-digit number to rehearse, not to forget. And I give Bonnie a shorter number, a two-digit number.
And give me the two-digit number, please.
Okay, you got the two, she gets the seven. But either way we do it, the one who's rehearsing the seven has just less cognitive space, less mental space left for other things. And it could take funny forms. For example, let's assume both of you want to eat healthy. The one who's rehearsing the seven-digit number is more likely, while they're doing that, to eat the brownie as opposed to the fruit, as opposed to the one who's rehearsing the two-digit number. You just have less attention left, less mind left to control what you're eating. So you're much more likely to just grab what appeals without thinking about it. And similarly, other cognitive performance. And so in some sense, what we're finding here is that being preoccupied by something just is a little bit like rehearsing the longer digit number. It just leaves you less mind for other things. You're absolutely right. You know, Buddhists and others who have trained for many, many years can get better at it, and they can divide attention more carefully and with greater control. But at the end of the day, even for them, if you impose more load, there'll be less elsewhere. It's a finite resource.
I was just going to ask you about when you mentioned the dieting thing. You talk a lot about, you know, people's inability to diet and why. Would you explain that?
Well, it's the same sort of trap.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not a dieting expert, so I can, you know, tell you the literature we read and how it conforms with the other issues that we found about scarcity. There's quite a bit of data now that when you diet, you're a little bit less smart during that time. And for very similar reasons, you're busy counting calories, attending to what you're eating, paying attention to all that stuff, and it leaves you with less resources. And what that means is that occasionally when you have less resources, you're going to fail. And when you fail, the diet doesn't work. And so it's a bit of a vicious circle. You know, when we sit, you know, if we meet for lunch and have a nice conversation, I am preoccupied, I'm devoted to the conversation, I'm focusing on it, and I have less mind left for what's happening around me. What that means in real time is I'm much more likely to eat the bread that's on the table than otherwise, and I don't want to eat bread. And so what I look like, I look like somebody who lost self-control. Now, I didn't really lose self-control. I didn't even notice the bread was there. I impulsively reached for it while my bandwidth is devoted to our conversation, and I ate not what I meant to eat. And so dieting, in that sense, is a real challenge because you have to devote a lot of mental resources to it. When you're able to devote a lot of mental resources to it, you have less resources left for other things, and you often are found to underperform. And when you devote enough to other things, you fail on your diet.
So it's not because you're not getting enough calories or enough sugar to the brain or any of that.
You know, I don't want to say that. I mean, I'm not a nutritionist, so
it
sounds to me completely credible that you also pay the price of, you know, nutritional deficiency if you're dieting unwisely. I suspect that if you know how to diet, you probably suffer less from those biological deficiencies. But be that as it may, again, what we found is that keeping all that constant, if I simply load you mentally on having to count calories and manage dieting, you have less mind left for other things you need to do, and you start forgetting and failing.
We're speaking again with Eldar Shafir. He's a professor of psychology and public affairs at Princeton University. He's the co-author of the book Scarcity, Why Having Too Little Means So Much. Another short break. And a reminder that it is our fall fund drive, and we encourage you to support Topical Currents and WLRN with a call of support to 1-866-247-9576. 1-866-247-9576 or WLRNradio.org, because we're not fundraising really during the program, so we're leaving it to you. Another short break. We'll be right back.
And we do return. It's today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. It's today's Topical Currents, and we're speaking with Eldar Shafir about the book he's co-written called Scarcity, Why Having Too Little Means So Much. He's a Princeton University professor of psychology and public affairs. Professor Shafir, tell us a little more about you and your background and how you came to be at Princeton and how you came to write this book.
Well, I was born in Tel Aviv in Israel. A lot of Israelis come to the States for graduate school. I actually came for undergraduate. That's a little bit more unusual. I went to Brown University. Then I got my PhD at MIT. And I did a brief postdoc at Stanford with a man by the name of Amos Tversky, who was very influential in the study of decision making and the tension between sort of psychological discoveries and economic assumptions. And I took a job at Princeton and found myself devoting most of my research energies to behavioral economics related issues, to how psychological findings impact our assumptions about economic behavior.
You've certainly been in the top-notch university category.
Yeah, I've been very lucky that way, yes.
Professor, I'd like, you know, to turn our attention to some solutions here because I don't want to leave it where we are. Speaking of vicious circles, you say that poverty is so overwhelming and distracting that the poor can't think clearly enough to improve their lives. So how do they overcome it given all of these findings?
That's a wonderful question, and I think to some extent, despite the concern with, you know, paternalistic issues in the U.S., I think we shouldn't count on them to do it alone. I think the, you know, policymakers and all of us need to take these issues more into concern and think about how to create good solutions. Here's one way to think about it. You know, we're talking about the limited bandwidth. When you spend too much time on one thing, you have less bandwidth for the rest. What that means is if I facilitate certain aspects of your life, if I liberate some of that bandwidth for you, you can devote it to other places. And it's interesting because that means that if I make your budgeting, for example, easier, if I give you automatic deposits, automatic payments, if I make banking more friendly and more trustworthy and more easy to manage, if I do all that, I give you some bandwidth back, which you can then dedicate to taking your medications on time or to spending more time with your children. And so in some sense, what we need to think about is how to facilitate the everyday life of those who don't have enough. It's interesting, if you think about us managing time scarcity, we get a lot of help. You know, if you have enough money and not enough time, you can buy, you know, nannies and drivers and maids and accountants and lawyers and all kinds of people who help you get more time. When you don't have enough money, it's kind of hard to do. And so the thing is, we need to think about how to do that, to design a situation where people just have more bandwidth to manage.
So what are some suggestions? What kind of reforms do we want to see?
Well, here is one. When I let's take the most poor. By the way, here is a footnote that's interesting. If you think about the studies we talk about in New Jersey and India and other places, these are not people who are living in abject poverty. These are simply people who are budgeting carefully from day to day, from month to month. These are people who are budget concerned. Mm-hmm. So if you think about the people we approached in the mall in New Jersey, we're talking, you know, 100 to 150 million Americans and growing, unfortunately. This is not the poor. It's just the budgeted. And so it's an issue that concerns many of us. And anything you do to facilitate those bandwidth issues can help. There's some work recently been done on, you know, defaulting people into retirement for savings. And the data on what happens if you default people, in other words, when people get a job, instead of telling them, here's the number, call and join, you tell them, we've joined you, here's a number, and you can call if you'd like to remove yourself. That makes an enormous, enormous difference. Many more people then find themselves saving for retirement, which at some point, when you get a little older, it makes a big difference to the bandwidth you have and, you know, the management of everyday life that you have when you've been able to save more.
Professor, Go ahead.
If you go to the other extreme, people who, for example, are in SNAP or, you know, receiving our version of food stamps, if I receive food stamps and then 1 month I get a little bit more money because I do a few more hours of work, I might not qualify for food stamps that month. The way the system works now is at that point I have to apply again to receive them next month. And so you get these, you know, single mothers who are struggling, having to apply for food stamps 3, 4, 5 times a year. It's a lot of work, it's a lot of imposition, and it's an enormous demand on their bandwidth. And then, by the way, if I'm approved the next month, it takes a month to get the money. So the month I didn't have money, I'm poor. And then a month or two later, when I get it back, I'm rich. And managing months that are bad and months that are good is much harder than having a more steady flow. And now the question is, of course, we can't solve all these issues, but it's pretty clear that those who devise those policies haven't spent enough time worrying about the bandwidth requirements. How to do it so it's a little bit easier. If I've already applied last month, is there an easier way to apply again rather than go back and sit down for all the forms again? How do we make things a little bit easier? That becomes an important issue. Think about it this way. Take somebody who's very poor and you want to offer them a benefits program. It would never occur to you to charge them $200 to join. The whole point is they have no money. You wouldn't charge the money to join this program. Mm-hmm. Well, it turns out the same person is also bandwidth poor. They are managing, they're spending a lot of time managing day to day. They not only don't have money, they also don't have bandwidth. So anything we can do to facilitate, instead of charging them a lot of bandwidth costs by making them show up at a certain amount, at a certain appointment at a certain time, dressed a certain way with 12 pages of complicated forms to fill out, anything we can do to facilitate that could make an enormous difference. Some recent studies have shown that if you simply fill out the form for them, that increases people's receipt of, for example, FAFSA, it's a government program to go to college, by 30-40%. So, you know, these are people who know all about it. You've told them they're eligible. If you simply fill out the form for them, they're 30% more likely to go to college than if you leave it for them to do in a world with scarce attentional resources.
But who can fill out the form for somebody?
Well, you know, we hire people at, you know, minimum wage to sit at a government office or the social welfare office and help people fill out their forms. It's much cheaper than things we've tried to do to get people to go to college. This is a very cheap intervention if we take issues of bandwidth and attention seriously and implement them in everyday life.
Well, if somebody is going to college, shouldn't they be able to fill out these forms?
Absolutely, and they are able to. The way I'm able to write my will, and I haven't done so yet. So that's the issue. When you're fighting fires from day to day, things are a bit less pressing. Even if they're very important, get relegated for another day.
You and I, we
eat healthy, we exercise a lot, just not today because today is busy, but tomorrow we'll exercise. And what happens then is you get people who have not applied to college, who have not exercised enough, who have not written their will, knowing they ought to do it and capable of doing it, but it just waits for a day when you're fighting fewer fires.
Now, you talked about this term bandwidth and cognitive control. Now, you had to be scheduled to do this interview with us this hour. You're at the Broadcast Center at Princeton, New Jersey. Obviously, you had to manipulate your schedule to be able to do that. And is there something that's kind of nagging at you that you wish you were elsewhere?
Well, first of all, I ran here a little bit late. I was planning to be here 50 minutes before we went on the air, and I got here only 6 minutes before, and that's not good. I failed to grab a cup of coffee before we got here. I mean, I have a bit of a sore throat. I had a big plan. I failed. And yes, of course, you know, I'm kind of flailing a little bit. I'm trying hard to manage things better. I've learned some things from the book. Here is something I don't do, for example. When I was waiting for you, so I was already in at about 6 minutes, I was told I had 6 minutes before we started talking. Mm-hmm. What I would have done a year ago is quickly use that time to check my email. I don't do that anymore because I've learned now that if there is one piece of email there that's distracting enough, that's important enough, it will take bandwidth away from me while we converse. And that wasn't worth it. So now I'm a little bit more into micromanaging my bandwidth. I don't look at email 5 minutes before an important meeting. I also leave more slack throughout my schedule. I know that things will get pushed around. I'll not plan very well. I'll start running behind. Meetings will get later and later. So I create slack. I create half an hour throughout the day, little windows where I can catch up, catch a breath, and fix the latenesses and start again. Slack has a big impact on our everyday management.
So going back to that suitcase, I liked that about the suitcase, that when you have a big suitcase with a lot of slack, you don't have to think so much about what you're putting in it as when you have a small suitcase that you have to pack very carefully.
Exactly. So if you think about going on a trip and you take the things that you really must take with you, if you have a small suitcase, by the time you put those small things in, the things you really need to take, the suitcase is full. If you have a very big suitcase, of course, you know, you put the important things, you get to the stuff that matters less, and then you say, you know what, instead of taking a third pair of shoes or a third book, I'll just leave some slack for things that might come up. And what that means is that, you know, you're walking down the streets of Miami tomorrow, or I guess in your case, let's say London. If you see a pair of shoes you like and you have a small suitcase, you have a problem. You can say, look, it's a good price, I want these shoes, but what do I take out of my suitcase to make room for these shoes? You enter trade-off thinking, which is very common in the world of those who don't have enough. It's constantly, if I do this, what do I not do instead? Notice even with time, if you're very busy and I ask you, do you want to go to the movies? You ask yourself, is this a movie I want to see? And then you ask yourself, well, if I go, what do I not do tonight that I was planning to do tonight that I was going to do tomorrow? If you have a big suitcase, if you have slack, all that's easy. You see the pair of shoes, you like them, the price is right, you buy them, you throw them in a suitcase, no problem. If you have a lot of time and I ask you, do you want to go to movies? You say, what's the movie? Sure, I'll go. It makes everyday life a lot easier, much less trade-off thinking, and a much easier way to recover from bad planning. So if you go to Seattle and you forgot to buy a raincoat and it's raining, no problem, you buy the raincoat, you throw it in. If you don't have room, if you don't have money, that's a bigger problem. You start looking wet and silly.
So developing or leaving room for or building slack is something we can do in our everyday lives where we can to prevent this feeling of scarcity.
Indeed. And that takes us in some interesting way back to the Buddhists that we talked earlier. You know, there's at least two extreme schools. You know, capitalism says, you know, when your suitcase is tight, build a bigger suitcase, you know, make more money. And, you know, Buddhism says to some extent, you know, develop more modest tastes. So you have more room in the same small suitcase. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a fun juggling act. For those who have enough, a more modest taste is very reasonable. Of course, when you get to the minimum, then that option you don't really have. If you have and you live in a very, very small subsidized housing and eat very cheap food, in those cases, you know, a cheaper taste is not really the way to go. You really need a larger suitcase.
Again, we're speaking with Professor of Psychology and Public Affairs at Princeton University, Dr. Eldar Shafir, and he's the co-author with Senthil Malanathan, Professor of Economics at Harvard University. Malanathan, right?
That's good.
Okay.
Malanathan.
Scarcity, why having too little means so much. One more short break and a short reminder for you that it is our fall fund drive, and we would love to hear from you at 866-247-9576. Very grateful to have you with us, and we'd be grateful to have your support. WLRNradio.org. And we're back with today's Topical Currents, Monday edition. Joseph Cooper here with Bonnie Berman. And we're speaking with Professor of Psychology and Public Affairs at Princeton University, Dr. Eldar Shafir, who co-authored the book Scarcity, Why Having Too Little Means So Much. And we'd love to hear from you, our contributors right now during the program, because we are not doing fundraising, just little teeny bits to remind you that it is our fall fund drive, and we do have a scarcity of funds here at WLRN, and we could definitely use your support. 866.
We need to be motivated.
Yes, and we also are giving away those three Apple iPad minis and a $2,500 Apple gift card, all great reasons, but of course it's to support the programming. 866-247-9576 or WLRNradio.org. Go ahead.
Professor, talk a little more about the vicious cycle of falling behind. Many people have the money to pay their bills, but let them slide and wind up paying penalties. What's behind that?
Well, you know, basically when you're focusing heavily on managing the day-to-day challenges of having barely enough or not even that, you neglect a lot of things in the periphery. So, if you look at the everyday management of, for example, managing a checking account that's always very close to zero and trying to avoid overdraft, it gets to be a very, very careful and subtle juggling act that requires a lot of your attention. And when you do enough of that, day in and day out, you will occasionally fail. You will occasionally miss something, or there is what economists call the small financial shock. You know, your car breaks down. You need to pay a doctor for an appointment. At those moments, as you're juggling and encounter moments of difficulty, you know, you resort to what you can. You know, there's a fire and there's a bucket near you, and, you know, what happens to the bucket later is not your concern. Right now, there's a fire. And so you do things like take a payday loan. Payday loans have become extremely popular. They're, you know, a matter of some controversy, and, you know, they help you right now, but often at a high cost, because what you're not focusing on right now, what's in the periphery, is the implications of the high interest on your ability to pay 2 weeks from now. And people who take payday loan very often then have to take a payday loan to pay it back. And they get into these cycles, and they're not getting any richer, but their obligations get bigger, and that's a classic trap. Now, what's interesting, if you take, for example, work on loneliness, if you're somebody who was experiencing the scarcity of social connections, you're lonely. What some studies have shown that's remarkably interesting is that when you don't think about your loneliness, in moments when you're doing other things, you're socially just as capable, just as good as other people. But the moments you think about your loneliness, and paradoxically, those often happen exactly at the moment when you meet somebody who you'd like to impress, you have a potential friend. At those moments, you think about being lonely, and that reduces your social abilities, your social intelligence. You do less well then. And again, you can see the vicious cycle. You're feeling lonely. We know you're capable, but at the moment when that weighs on you, you do less well in the next social interaction. You're awkward. You don't listen to my joke. You respond not quite right, and you don't make more friends. And this is a very similar cycle.
So this is all such self-defeating behavior everywhere. I mean, these vicious cycles.
Well, it's, you know, I don't know if it's self-defeating, but it's the brain-defeating behavior. You know,
well, I guess, yeah.
We try to do the best we can, but we have limited machinery. You see, what's so interesting about the behavioral work more generally, if you get into it, is that, you know, we have a complicated machinery, and there is this illusion that we understand, you know, we're the proud owners of this brain, and we think we know what it does, but we don't any more than we understand our livers. So our brains do their thing, and we don't quite always get it, although we think we might. And yes, you're right, Bonnie, in some sense that the brain is doing something that's not helping us in those moments.
Before we're getting a little short on time, before we go, let me remind our listeners that we'll have links to the book Scarcity at both the WLRN.org website and also at the Topical Currents Facebook page.
And Professor, I see that I don't know what your role is, this Innovations for Poverty Action, which is poverty-action.org. What is that exactly, and what is your role in the organization?
We have a number of these. So the Innovations for Poverty Action is a wonderful organization that does a lot of behavioral interventions, mostly in developing countries, but not only. It tries to basically take behavioral insight and apply it to studying problems that affect the poor in the third world. I'm an advisor there. I'm a member of the advisory team.
Oh, okay.
I'm also a founding member and on the board of another organization called Ideas 42 that does a lot of behaviorally informed policy interventions both in the U.S. and abroad. We basically, we try to help organizations, be it government or private organizations that need some help or thinking about issues, and we try to bring in behaviorally informed interventions to help policy.
Is that Ideas, the number 42?
Correct, ideas42.com.
.com. Right. Okay. Mm-hmm.
That's where you can find us on the web. The organization is Ideas 42.
Yeah, we'll have links on our Facebook page. Your co-author said, the biggest mistakes I've made in life were when I had too little time. The second biggest are when I had too much time. Explain that. Explain that phenomenon. What is that?
He's a funny guy, but he touches on something very important. So scarcity is what we talked about. And then the other side of things is what happens when you have plenty, when you have abundance. And when you have abundance, you get to be a little bit less careful. You kind of lay back and let things happen. And you can make a lot of mistakes that way too. And so we talk about in the book what happens if you sort of you feel you have enough and you start mismanaging just because you're not concerned. You can make mistakes of all sorts. Here's a funny one. You go to supermarkets, there's a phenomenon called quantity surcharge. Quantity surcharge is when you pay more when you buy a bigger package. So if, let's say, half a pound of spinach costs $5, a full pound of spinach costs $12. Now, that sounds silly because we mostly think that bigger packages should be less per unit price. And that's exactly the point. So marketers know that you, who have plenty and don't worry about prices in supermarkets, just grab the bigger package, assuming that it's going to be less. And it turns you pay a surcharge. It's a classic mistake that comes from not paying attention. What's so cute is that this particular trick, this quantity surcharge, you will not find in supermarkets in poor neighborhoods because the poor check the prices, unlike you, and know this is a silly deal. I'll just buy two packages of half a pound instead of a full pound.
And yet their prices may be higher than other areas.
Which is a whole different story. That's correct. So, Joseph, you're right about that. But the falling into this trick of buying bigger packages despite the fact that they cost you more is a luxury of those who live in a world of plenty, and we make a lot of those mistakes.
Well, we've been speaking with Professor of Psychology and Public Affairs at Princeton University, Eldar Shafir. He conducts research in cognitive science, judgment and decision-making, and behavioral economics. He co-authored with Senthil Melanathan, Professor of Economics at Harvard University, the book Scarcity, Why Having Too Little Means So Much. And two other websites for you, poverty-action.org and ideas42.com.
And get to work on that will, Professor.
Yeah.
I promise.
Thank you so much, Professor, for joining us today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you both.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening this hour. Our producer is Richard Ives. Technical direction from Caroline Brader Watts. Also help from Paul Leary, who's online producer. Again, we have free audio archives and downloads at WLRN.org and more information as well at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Bonnie, want to drop in the phone number?
Yes, it's 866-247-9576 or online at simple, WLRNradio.org.
And to the calendar, September 23rd, on this day in 1920, 93 years ago, the birth of actor Mickey Rooney in Brooklyn, the star of the Andy Hardy series. He was in 14 episodes. He was a husband of Ava Gardner and a born-again Christian in the 1970s. Also on this day in 1926, 87 years ago, the birth of jazz sax icon John Coltrane in Hamlet, Georgia. He played in both Miles Davis's and Thelonious Monk's bands. Giant Steps, My Favorite Things. And one more. On this day in 1930, 83 years ago, the birth of the great Ray Charles in Albany, Georgia. Of course, the music for Georgia on My Mind was written by Hokie Carmichael. One more phone number.
Okay, 866-247-9576. Support WLRN, support Topical Currents, WLRNradio.org.
Ray Charles was the father of 12 children. He died in 2004. So we leave with a thought from Mickey Rooney, who was actually born Joseph Yule. Quote, "A lot of people have asked me how short I am. Since my last divorce, I think I'm about $100,000 short." Thanks for listening today. Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman. Stay with us next hour for Here and Now from NPR News.